Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We're going to get back to our origins today and go without a guest. The only time we've ever done this up to now is on our very first episode where we were, it seems like ages ago, Jody, we sat in the Texas Supreme Court courtroom and recorded our very first episode and live and in person.
It's hard to believe that was early March and how much the world has changed since then. And, you know, I've barely left my house since then, honestly.
At least it feels same that here. Way. Yeah. I mean, I ventured out to run a couple of errands and it felt like I was coming back from an extended vacation or something. You know, landmarks didn't look the same. And
exactly.
It was a very strange experience. So what we thought we might do for the listeners today is just, we've had some recent developments going on that I think are worthy of some conversation that don't necessarily require a special guest. And we've troubled Blake Hawthorne twice already to be on the show. He would be a logical guest to have on for an episode like this. But I think we're just going to have a conversation between the two of us about primarily about the ransomware attack on the Supreme Court and Court of Appeals websites from 2 weeks ago and how that's affecting our practices, things to think about, things we've observed. But before we do that, I want to mention a couple of housekeeping items about the podcast itself. We're in the process of completing a change in our web hosts, and the company that we're using is working with our web developer and is putting out a really nice looking website that really features our guests and includes, in addition to links to podcast player, a really nice transcription of the episode. And so folks can get on that site. We're still at texapplawpod.com. You can visit that site to see each individual episode. The back episodes are being built out and added periodically. We've got our most recent two episodes up right now. This one will be on the site when it goes live and is published. It adds a nice element, the design of the site and linking to social media, contact information for guests, and has a podcast player right there in the webpage. So we're pleased with how that's going so far. And we're also happy to report, Jody, I'll update you with our latest number. And we're looking at more than 1,500 total plays for all episodes so far. So for our fledgling little podcast with two boring dudes who sit around and talk about appellate law, I mean, that's not bad, I don't think.
That's exactly right. And, you know, outside of my extended family, that means more people are listening than just the people who have to because they're related to me. So that's great. Thank y'all so much out there for listening and continuing to listen. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, it really has been great. I've really enjoyed doing this with you too. And I've learned a lot as we've gone. So we're going strong and we're going to continue to do this and put out an episode every week for the foreseeable future. I think we're onto something here. So I'm super happy with how it's going. One other thing to mention here is we have been blessed with sponsorship by a couple of entities that a lot of our listeners will have heard of. One is Thomson Reuters, who, as most folks know, is the owner of Westlaw Next, the research database platform that a good number of folks who do what we do use. I am a Westlaw Next user myself. I use it every day in my practice and really couldn't get by without it.
Same here. I think I've spent more time today with Westlaw Next than I have with anyone else in my house. So I've done a lot of researching and updating today, specifically on that platform.
It is super useful. And we're not going to put our sponsors in our listeners' faces a lot, but you know, there may be opportunities to hear from our sponsors about different things that they do that benefit folks in our practice area. Certainly Westlaw Next is one of those that would benefit our listeners to hear more about. But the second sponsor that I wanted to mention at the outset today is Court Surety Bond Agency, or CSBA. Most appellate lawyers have to deal with supersedious bonds in their practices, and CSBA is a leader in that industry. They're based in California, but most folks here in Texas have heard of them. They are fairly regular fixtures at the statewide appellate seminars. And they do a good job of reaching out to appellate lawyers and letting us know what they do and how we can benefit from their services. And so we're looking forward to enjoying a partnership with them as well as Thomson Reuters to help bring the podcast to you.
And we've worked on that, and that's going to allow us to kind of change our production. You've heard about the website. Our production companies are changing in the way our episodes are being edited and produced too. So we're really thankful for their generosity and willing to support us this way. And we're excited that we're going to get more great content out to y'all because of it.
That's right. So thanks again to Thomson Reuters and CSBA, and you'll be hearing more about them as we move along. So the hot topic, Jody, right now is the ransomware attack on the Texas Supreme Court and Court of Appeals websites. We could, I'm sure, talk for way longer than 30 minutes on that topic, but I figured we would chat today about that. As I mentioned at the outset, Thames, I will tell you, I knew I used Thames a lot in my practice to access information over the internet through the court dockets and so forth, but I felt pretty paralyzed in the last 2 weeks. What about you?
Yeah, you know, if I were going to pick a playlist for the ransomware, I think I'd pick You Picked a Fine Time to Leave Me, Lucille by Kenny Rogers, and You Don't Know What You've Got Till It's Gone by Cinderella. Because, I mean, seriously, you know, I bragged and bragged for the first 2 months of quarantine that I could do whatever I wanted to do from home. And, you know, gosh, it's so great and everything's so accessible. And then Thames went down, and it turns out that I feel like about 50% of what I do somehow involves Thames on a daily basis, because I'll go to log in to do something and then, oops, that doesn't work. And I just have to remember it.
Yeah, that's right. I was kind of in the same boat. I mean, I'm on the sites all the time. I'm downloading, you know, records from the attorney portal, which is tied into that system. Case mail, you know, is related to that system. So, and the regular opinions and orders lists coming out of all the courts, not just the Supreme Court. I mean, it's a habit for me when I sit down at my computer in the morning. You know, one of the first things I do is check and see what the Third Court of Appeals is doing that day. And yep. I'm not ashamed to say, I felt just discombobulated in the last 2 weeks.
I totally agree. I mean, thankfully, they've started pushing out some of the orders from the courts on the new txcourts.net site. But, you know, one of my favorite things, and I think this says a lot about me, unfortunately, is, you know, one of my favorite things to do always has been on Thursdays to go to the court that released on Thursdays, and on Fridays to go to the courts that released there and kind of click through and see what opinions were coming out and who the counsel were and look at the briefing and kind of see what the issues were. And I miss that as much as that says about me, unfortunately, but
I think it just says that you're a dedicated appellate lawyer, because that sounds completely normal.
Yeah, I think I feel that way and my coworkers feel that way, but you know, other people probably sounds kind of weird, but I think the listeners and the podcast will sympathize with that.
Right. So, I mean, if anyone who's listening now doesn't know, on May the 8th, that morning, the txcourts.gov site, which is the parent site for basically OCA, you know, created these sites for all the Texas appellate courts, got attacked by a ransomware virus. I've heard it called the second wave virus because it, you know, we've been dealing with enough of a hardship with the coronavirus situation, and now this hits. But literally, you know, we didn't know. This was the day that we recorded the episode with David Slate that this happened. And we didn't know, other than the fact that the sites were down and that we didn't get Supreme Court orders on Friday the same way that we usually would, what was going on. All we knew that the sites were down. And then within a couple of days, OCA issued a release saying, yeah, we got hit with ransomware. We're not paying the ransom. We haven't lost any data. That's been the big saving grace in all this, as everyone should be assured that all the courts are saying that there has been no data loss in all this. And in fact, as we're recording this episode, the sites are starting to come back up. I received some notifications from the Third Court site today, actually doing things like, you know, giving me the file stamp copies of my motions that were filed back around the 12th or 13th, and then also ruling on some extension requests related to those same filings. So, you know, everyone should be assured that the court sites are backed up. In addition to what OCA was doing, I know that the Supreme Court Clerk's Office had some internal backups there. And that's one of the ways that txcourts.net site was created, was by restoring some data that was already available.
That site has been really useful because you can at least get some of the orders that are coming out of the courts. You can get the opinions that are coming out piece by piece. They're starting to trickle in, I think, from almost all the courts, it looks like. And then I know the Fifth Court has its own backup site, that the old courtstuff.net site that was around forever before they fully standardized onto the Thames system. So there are still ways to access that stuff now. And it seems like it's all getting a little bit more standardized.
Right. You mentioned court stuff. It brought back memories for me to see that URL being used, because I started my career as a younger lawyer in Dallas And that was, you know, pre-Thames. And so, you know, the Fifth Court of Appeals in Dallas was ahead of its time in getting that site prepared and posting orders and everything. It was really a precursor of sorts to Thames and our current system. And I think, honestly, it's kind of a funny part of this. I think the Fifth Court kind of reluctantly gave way to Thames because it had a pretty strong following and was pretty used to the way it did things. But, you know, the Supreme Court said mandatory e-filing means use our system. And now, of course, everything is up until now has gone, you know, swimmingly.
Mm-hmm.
With that.
It has. You know, the things that I think have been more difficult is once you get used to getting the automated case mail in all the cases where you get your notifications of things that were filed, of rulings from the court and all that, I kind of miss it because, you know, the last couple of weeks you file something and you may or may not get the actual file stamp copy. You get your file stamp copy, you get your notices, and you haven't really gotten those in a couple of weeks. And so it's been a little bit hard to just kind of push something out there and hope that it lands or get a notice from the court, not know what's out there. You know, and when you're used to getting instantaneous notices, it really does make it hard to not.
Oh, that's right. I mean, I was used to getting a confirmation of my submission, which actually still has been happening. Thankfully, this did not affect eFile Texas. But then, you know, most of the courts are pretty good about turning around your filings reasonably quickly, if not within, you know, an hour or even two, certainly the next business day, especially if it was a late afternoon filing. And then suddenly my initial take on all this was that the intermediate appellate courts had become basically black holes. You know, I was submitting things, but nothing was coming out. I felt a little guilty for using that terminology a little bit later because I didn't mean to imply that the courts weren't doing work. I think they were just as paralyzed as we were. And from everything I've heard, you know, the justices didn't have access to Thames either. They couldn't get, you know, the only thing they had available to them was documents that they already had pulled down in some other fashion. And so it's been an extreme challenge, I think, for the courts to put out any meaningful work over this time. You know, the Supreme Court set up basically a whole alternative system, relying largely on not only this txcourts.net site, but also, I mean, we've heard even more than usual from Blake Hawthorne and the Supreme Court Twitter account, aside from Blake's personal Twitter account. And then the court, one thing that Blake pointed out really early on was that documents that were submitted over the e-filing system are automatically loaded into the Research Texas system. So in theory, one should be able to, if documents are submitted, should be able to pull up the docket for that case on Research Texas and have everything there available. And I think that was one of the things that the Supreme Court used to cobble together a temporary system that has, I think, with the Supreme Court has done pretty well with keeping things moving. I don't think that court's missed too much of a beat, but we're having a much bigger challenge with the intermediate courts of appeals, I'm afraid.
Well, and it's a lot harder for them because they don't have the same kind of docket that the Supreme Court does either. So many of them are original proceedings, accelerated proceedings, all that stuff. And, you know, in addition to just the regular steady flow of cases that they can't just say pet denied on. So I can only imagine the surge of things that have hit them in addition to all this. Plus, a lot of them were doing remote work anyway and trying to transition to that, which is already a whole other challenge.
That's true. I mean, the Supreme Court has no criminal jurisdiction and then discretionary jurisdiction. And although it's getting its cases come from, you know, 14 intermediate courts, if you just look at the docket numbers in the Supreme Court, usually on any given year, there's about 100 or maybe 120 matters filed of all kinds. And the courts of appeals, the volume in those courts is much, much different. Plus, they're getting all the civil cases, but also, you know, all the criminal cases too. And so that is a much different level of activity in the clerk's offices. And, you know, with Thames being down, nothing coming in, you're seeing, you know, kind of just an unreal backlog of stuff happening. But, you know, the courts have started to come through it. And now, as I understand it, just today, well, recently, the txcourts.gov sites have started to be rebuilt. Some limited version of them is currently available online. I think it consists largely of just backup data. I don't know that anything new has really been added yet, but it's at least going back to the point where those sites were backed up. And then new information, OCA and David Slayton's folks are working round the clock to get the information up to date. And it's just going to take a while for this process to play out.
Yeah. In fact, I know a couple of attorneys who had oral arguments scheduled either this week or the next week that got canceled because the courts just simply couldn't get to the materials they needed to prepare. You know, one of those things that you don't think about even though the website's down, you think you'd be able to have oral argument. But if the court can't get to all the things they need, then it's not going to be helpful to anybody.
That's right. And, you know, in the face of coronavirus, all the courts were doing a good job of pivoting and making oral argument, scheduling oral argument through Zoom. You know, the Supreme Court got a lot of attention on a national basis for getting Zoom arguments kicked off, and had one even, I believe it was yesterday, on the voting by mail issue. And, but yeah, it was able to move forward with that because it had this other system in place where, you know, it could communicate with the lawyers. And my understanding is that, you know, they're actually working out the kinks pretty well so that the Zoom arguments are going pretty smoothly now. No technical difficulties like what David Slayton told us about when he was on the show.
Yeah, it seems like it. I've watched some at the Supreme Court and I've watched a couple at the intermediate courts, and they seem like they all go off pretty well. Now, I know there's a lot of behind the scenes work that gets into that, but from the viewer perspective, just watching it on the YouTube channel, they go off pretty seamlessly.
It is kind of interesting that around the time the courts really kind of get up and running on Zoom, I mean, they're having their conferences over Zoom, they're starting to have oral arguments over Zoom, and then this hits, the ransomware mm-hmm. hits, and just it just a whole another level of paralysis. I want to say, I know how hard all those folks have been working. And I know, you know, OCA has been just going crazy trying to get this resolved. The folks in the Supreme Court and other clerk's offices are doing their very best. We're in good hands. You know, this would have been a disaster had there been a data loss. One thing I was reminded of was that the Supreme Court back, you know, 20 years or so, I think, input old data online, old court orders and things that, you know, I don't know, you know, those documents still exist. So it could have really been tragic. But of course, our folks planned well, planned ahead, and executed the plan. And so we're not in any danger of losing information. It's what we're dealing with is really, sadly, just more of an inconvenience than anything.
It is. It's just one of those things that I think feels that much more acute now that we're all, you know, doing stay-at-home orders for coronavirus. If I were in the office, it probably wouldn't seem quite as extreme as it does when this is kind of the only thing that you do during the day from your computer at home.
Right. I am seeing, though, you know, one question I kind of threw out to Twitter about a week ago or so was, we were in this black hole situation and the documents weren't as freely available for those coming out of the intermediate courts of appeals as they have been for the Supreme Court. And so the thought kind of formed in my mind that, you know, maybe there needs to be some kind of a blanket order extending some deadlines. Because I know for me, I was having an issue getting a reporter's record in a case where I've got a filing deadline. It's a time-sensitive set deadline that the court, 14th court set for me for 4 p.m. tomorrow. And I couldn't get on the attorney portal to download the record, even though the court reporter supposedly filed it. I wasn't getting it despite several requests from my opposing counsel. Turns out later, it was even a third layer of problem was my virus scanner on my incoming email software was a little hyper-aggressive and actually blocked the opposing counsel's request to, or his effort rather, to send this stuff to me. So fortunately, I didn't accuse him of anything nefarious. But that was, you know, that was when I realized just how dependent I am on these systems being up and running, you know, with 99.9% uptime or whatever they are. You know, I was sitting around, couldn't get my hands on this record no matter what I did. And so now I'm kind of scrambling a little bit to get this response in. The technology, we all depend on it. And when it goes down, it's a big deal. But here, you know, I don't know what the source of the ransomware attack was, you know, if it was someone who clicked on something that they shouldn't have. That's kind of the classic MO, I think. And I'm certainly not pointing any fingers. I mean, this kind of thing is going to happen. And I understand that now, too. There's been another attack on maybe, is it DPS? I don't know if you've heard about that, Jerry.
Yeah, there's some other government agency. I don't remember what it was, but you're right.
So the bad guys are trying to exploit the situation that we're all in. So
don't click on any unknown podcast emails. We don't want our new website to get locked up.
But we don't spam our listeners either. So
well, that's also true. That's true. We try not to.
The point I was coming to on the blanket orders was we're now starting to see some blanket orders coming out of the intermediate courts of appeals. On the 19th, the 1st and 14th granted a blanket extension for every case in which there is an appellate briefing deadline. Ordinary appeals, not child custody, not juvenile. One or two other exceptions. There has been some, the perceived well, there's been a perception that this is a significant enough issue that some of these courts are taking it upon themselves to issue these blanket orders and help practitioners out who, you know, might have been in a similar situation to what I was experiencing earlier this week, not being able to download an appellate record to start a brief, for example. Mm-hmm. And I think right now what we've got on those is the 1st and 14th courts in Houston, the 6th court, I believe, and the 11th.
Texarkana.
Yeah, and the 11th in Eastland.
Yep, I saw those come down yesterday.
And I kind of thought that we'd see them from pretty much all the courts, but the indications are now that that may not be happening.
And it may be that they're just kind of handling it on an as-needed basis.
Yeah, I think so. I think you could make the case either way. I mean, it'd be nice if all the courts were handling it the same, kind of like when the Supreme Court first issued the emergency orders that said, you know, the trial judges may extend the limitations. Mm-hmm. And there was a little bit of a backlash about that, folks saying, well, wait a minute, you know, where my court, where my case is, shouldn't determine what my statute of limitations is and fix that. And I don't know that that's going to happen here because, you know, being in appellate courts, this is a little different situation. I mean, you have longer term deadlines. Mm-hmm. And one thing that's being said, it may not be necessary, even though it's nice to have these blanket orders in defense of those courts that haven't put one out yet and may not. It may not be necessary. The courts are saying, you know, extensions are going to be freely granted. And so if anyone has a situation where they need an extension, you know, the remedy is still there. It's not like you're going to be, you know, out of luck.
Well, and that's been my experience really since we started the whole stay at home thing, is courts have been very forgiving on extensions and very understanding. Just, I mean, number one, by kind of the issues that are imposed by having to work from home for so many people. So if anything, I think this will just make them even a little bit more liberal with what was already a pretty easy process, and that the standards of appellate conduct already require, you know, agreement without any real good reason to oppose it. And there's not a whole lot of good reasons out there in a regular civil appeal anyway.
I can't think of one. I am loath to ever even consider opposing an extension, but right now I couldn't imagine a situation in which I would oppose one.
Yeah, it has to be a real prejudice to your client for some reason.
Well, you know, we've talked a little in previous episodes about how these recent events have led to some technological change in practice. What I thought I might ask you about is, you know, what questions, or maybe we just can discuss this for a minute. I mean, what questions does this situation raise? How do we think it's going to affect our practices in the future? Is that something you've had any chance to think about?
The ransomware or just the stay at home in general?
All of it, really.
You know, I think one thing that I think that's going to come from all this is it's going to make the overall practice more efficient. You know, I think this is going to make the practice of law a lot more efficient. I think we both recognize how lucky we were in Texas with the technological stuff that we had, Thames, e-filing, the attorney portal. And I think that this just underscores how great that is and how much better equipped Texas lawyers are because of it. And I think that the emphasis on that type of stuff is going to continue. I think the Zoom trial proceedings, I think Zoom oral arguments, I'm certain that they're not going to replace old-fashioned court and old-fashioned oral arguments, but I think in a lot of cases, they're going to be here to stay. You know, in particular, judges in small towns, more remote areas, I think they appreciate being able to have advocates from all over. And I think, frankly, and you know, they haven't really talked about it too much, it's an access to justice issue. It's going to solve, hopefully, a lot of access to justice problems that our state had, because, you know, we have so many rural and smaller communities that are just underserved by lawyers. And by allowing, I think, remote hearings and electronic proceedings like we've had, it really allows some attorneys from throughout the state to serve those communities in ways that they couldn't before.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think for me, what I would like to see come out of this is some things we've touched upon in prior episodes. You know, if you've got to go somewhere for a 15 or 30 minute hearing, you have to travel for half a day and or stay overnight. You know, this ties into the access to justice issue because it has to do with how expensive legal services are. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm going to travel to some remote location in West Texas, I've got to be compensated for the time that I'm spending doing that. And then the client's got to pay the expense. And then, you know, the hearing might take literally 15 minutes or 30 minutes or an hour. It is, you know, there really is no denying that Zoom is way more efficient and creates an efficiency that just really ought to take root. I'm trying to think of a good reason for opposing in that situation, allowing Zoom hearings to continue. And I think the judges in those more remote locations, you know, I can't speak for them, but if I were them, I would be inclined to want to keep that just because you could be so much more efficient in the running of your docket, I would think.
That's right. I think, you know, there are probably some situations where witness credibility may be an issue, or you've got a evidentiary stuff that needs to be in person. You know, I think there are plenty of reasons you can come up with why it might not work, but I think you're right. Make it kind of the general understanding that the court is encouraging of remote proceedings when available and applicable. And I think you're going to find a lot of attorneys take advantage of that.
Just so much a greater sheer number of hearings that take place in trial courts across the state. You know, I don't know that remote oral arguments are really going to take hold long-term for appellate matters unless there's some extenuating circumstance. It's interesting, and it will be interesting to watch. You know, one thing I would really like to see, though, even if remote arguments don't take hold, we've got a handful of intermediate courts here in our state that record arguments. And when those recordings are available to the advocates, it really is a big benefit. I know the third court publishes the audio, you know, within a day or so of the argument. I really enjoy, it's beneficial to my client to be able to hear the argument if they couldn't make it live. And then it's beneficial, gosh, you know, think about all the times you've told in response to a question, you know, well, hey, you know, judge, with the court's permission, we'll submit a supplemental brief on that question and follow up to your question. You know, but if you're the only person at the lectern, my brain works 100 miles an hour when I'm in an oral argument. It's just easier to get the details if you can go back and refer to a recording and really listen to the nuance of the question and try to figure out what's really being asked. And I think, you know, if we can pipe in video, even if we don't stick with video, you know, it would be nice, again, another act of justice, if all of our intermediate courts would record arguments and make them available. I think that would be a big plus, not necessarily related to coronavirus or ransomware, but just a kind of one of the things that's on my technological wish list.
Well, and, you know, to your point earlier in a different context, I feel like the intermediate courts are a little bit of a black hole for the general public. They don't really know what they do or what they are. And so if you have those videos available where you can actually see what an oral argument is, I think it goes a long way toward educating the public about what the system is about. Because 9 out of 10 people probably couldn't tell you who's on the Texas Supreme Court. But I think below that, you know, 999 out of 1,000 couldn't tell you who's on an intermediate court or where they're even located.
No, that is so true. That is so true. And we see that with the Texas Supreme Court arguments that have been now broadcast live and webcast and recorded and made available later for many years. I think that is a giant advantage for anyone to be able to look at an oral argument that takes place in the Texas Supreme Court. And so I'd like to think that we could get that level even of technological service into our intermediate courts, but I know that there are budgetary reasons why it hasn't happened, and mm-hmm. our budget's going to be tighter than ever going forward now. But, you know, the technology also has gotten a lot cheaper. So I would sure love to see that happen. If anyone ever puts me in charge and gives me an unlimited budget, that would be something I'd love to see. But
yeah, you know, it's interesting with Thames being down, all the things that I realize that I do in cases, a lot of time if I find a case that I'm researching on Westlaw from an intermediate court, you know, sometimes I'll use it to check the subsequent history because you can't tell from Westlaw in a fairly recent case if anything's been done, but also just going in a case that's similar to mine and reading the briefs, see what they presented, you know, that makes a big difference to be able to see what they put in, to look for the names of counsel who argued, maybe look for potential amicus support from other cases. You can do a lot of crosswork on Thames that presents a lot of value, and not having access to that is kind of frustrating because you do miss that. And that's a great technological advantage we have.
Oh, I totally agree. And when txcourts.gov started coming back, and I was able to actually see like the Third Court of Appeals website, you know, the real website again, I had this tinge of real appreciation for what we had. And what's kind of sad about it, I mean, you and I know all about this stuff because we're in it day in, day out. I think, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of Texas practitioners who don't understand and don't know all these resources that are available to them, like the attorney portal, for example, and case mail. I mean, things that to me are kind of appellate lawyer 101 sort of topics. They're must haves. And so, you know, to the extent that those lawyers have, because of the coronavirus situation, if they've had appeals and they've, you know, been forced to be online more and educate themselves more, I mean, that's a potential upside to all this very strange situation that we've been in for the last couple of months. But, you know, having cases available online and having as much information available online as possible in our age, I think is critical. And we have commended OCA and the Supreme Court many times in our discussions on the podcast and in our episodes so far. But I think their role has just become, you know, highlighted as even more important than we could have imagined, just because in the last 2 weeks, you know, we just haven't had this information.
Totally agree. And I think the fact that it's out there, you realize how much legitimacy it lends both to the judiciary and then to all of us and the jobs that we do, because people really can kind of transparency with what we do. Hey, I'm filing a brief. Okay, cool. What does that mean? You know, but well, here's the link. Go look at it. You can actually see what I've done. People who are law students who are studying can go and look. Hey, these people seem like they know what they're talking about.
Right. Well, I think we're pretty much at time. So I guess we'll wrap up. One thing I wanted each one of us to perhaps offer a tip, since we typically ask our guests to offer a tip. I've got one, and it may overlap with yours because it's topical to what we're talking about today.
Sure. But,
so the tip that I would offer is to visit that txcourts.net site. If you have a case now, you know, here we are, it is May 21st of 2020. And the court websites are coming back, but we don't know exactly when they're going to be back in full force. And if you've got a case where you think you've got a clock ticking on an appellate deadline, txcourts.gov/orders is the place to go, because those orders that we spoke about earlier from the 1st and 14th are posted there. From the 6th and the 11th are posted there. But there's a space for all of 14 intermediate appellate courts there. And as the sites come back online, I'm sure that each one of them will post their blanket order prominently on their homepages. But in the meantime, this is the place to go to figure out if you've got a blanket order in place that affects your case. And what that will tell you is, you know, whether you essentially got an automatic extension of time to file a brief, or if your opposing counsel will, and you can adjust your own briefing schedule accordingly. But there's, in addition to the actual opinions that are released on txcourts.net/opinions, txcourts.net/orders is a critical site for our listeners to be watching right now if they've got appellate matters pending in Texas.
And in a similar vein, I'll give mine my tip for the Supreme Court. If you are looking for data on Supreme Court cases and you still can't get to the TX Courts sites, Don Cruz has a great resource at scotxgotexblog.com. He tracks trends, he tracks data, he has information on what cases are pending at the briefing stage. Super helpful if you're trying to find out what's going on at the court right now, or frankly, even afterwards, because it lets you search the data in a way that the Supreme Court's website doesn't. You can certainly find individual cases there, but you can't look at it in the way that Don kind of does it. So that's another great resource if you're looking to learn about what's going on at the Texas Supreme Court overall or in specific cases.
Yeah, Don does a great job. He's programmed all that stuff where it pulls data out. I believe it pulls it from Thames. But he had all that stuff that had been pulled out and wasn't affected immediately by the ransomware attack. So some of the information that was available on his site, you couldn't access anywhere else. And so that was a real plus. Absolutely. Well, I think we'll wrap up then. Before we go, I want to again thank our sponsors for the podcast, Thomson Reuters, who brings to you Westlaw and a lot of other very practical online databases that appellate lawyers use on a regular basis, and CSBA, Court Surety Bond Agency. We're really glad to have these two companies in partnership with us, and we look forward to a long relationship into the future.
Absolutely. And thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who has rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email or message us on Twitter, or just reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.